They say that history is written by the victors. So what becomes of the stories handed down by those on the wrong side of history, by the vanquished? There's no better place to explore that question than right here in Missouri. After all, the Civil War ended more than 150 years ago, making slavery illegal throughout the United States. But in Clay County, residents have been grappling with some different ideas about how to memorialize the winners and losers of that conflict. KCUR's Danny Wood has this dispatch.
It's a cold evening in Liberty, Missouri, and I'm standing in the local cemetery, Fairview Cemetery, alongside a Civil War memorial remembering the losing side, the Confederates, and it consists of a gray column, and on top of that, a life-size statue of a Confederate soldier holding a gun, and his big handlebar mustache makes him look rather like a stoic and reliable character. But what sort of person does he really represent? Tonight, I'm going to find out. I'm on my way to a book launch in the local Historical Society's museum on the main square.
Hello.
The Clay County Museum and Historical Society has a 19th century wood-paneled interior that's beautiful. There are glass cabinets full of relics. An antique cannon dominates the floor of the entrance, and beyond, about 30 jovial locals, some very elegantly dressed, enjoying wine and snacks.
What's your name again?
Danny.
Okay. I'm Jana Jesse Becker. I'm the past president of the Clay County Museum and Historical Society. I put this book.
Jana tells me that her book is called Excerpts from the Diary of Judge A.H. Shelton. The excerpts are drawn from an unpublished memoir that was rediscovered in the museum a few years ago.
In a drawer.
The manuscript had been donated to the Historical Society by Alonzo Houston Shelton's granddaughter. Shelton was from Clay County, and his Civil War experience included surviving the Battle of Lexington, the Siege of Atlanta, a prisoner of war camp, and losing an arm. During that time, he also met the sweetheart he'd later marry.
He sold real estate for a long time after the war. He was a real estate man. And then he became the police judge in Excelsior.
Jana found the first-person descriptions of battles and local people so vivid, she decided to type them up and through the museum release these excerpts as a book. I ask her to summarize what Shelton was like. She reads a quote taken from the diary and highlighted on the book's back cover.
No nation, no state, no county on top of God's green earth ever furnished any better, any braver, any more gallant defenders of the old Constitution and for the rights of the South than noble old Clay County, Missouri.
This is Shelton, the idealist, fighting for a cause. But a few hundred feet from where we're talking, there are old houses with their slave quarters intact, where African Americans were chained to the walls. Was this old Constitution really worth defending, and how gallant were its defenders?
How does it complicate things for you when we're talking about someone who lived in a society that today would be regarded as completely morally bankrupt? Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
I think we have to remember that the times were different. It was just a whole different world. It wasn't right, of course, but it was what they needed to survive.
Jana says the new book contains the war entries from Shelton's diary. Anything controversial, like opinions about slavery and derogatory comments about African Americans, including any mention of the N-word, are left out. I ask if this might be sanitizing the history.
Well, I think it is sanitizing it, but we, as a museum board, discussed it and decided that's what we needed to do. That we didn't want to create any controversy or take any stand about that issue. We didn't want anybody to think that represented what we thought, because it doesn't, of course.
Not everybody at the book launch agrees with this view. I ask Liberty resident Angie Borger-Darlin how she thinks prominent people from the Confederate past should be remembered.
Oh, I think that's part of your past. It is. This area's past. I think warts and all, that you should show it.
Tonight, it's also the Clay County Historical Society's annual meeting. But the curator, Jay Thorne, agrees to talk with me, so we squeeze behind the now closed makeshift bar to find a quiet corner. Jay wasn't involved with the publishing of the book and says he doesn't agree with the board's decision to leave out controversial material. In the original memoir, Jay says Shelton uses the N-word while expressing hatred for the anti-slavery activist John Brown. Jay thinks this passage is historically important because it demonstrates that support for slavery was a key factor motivating Shelton's fight for the Confederacy. Jay is also concerned that the excerpted diary serves revisionist historians who could use it to portray the Confederate cause as a battle for states' rights rather than a defense of slavery. He says the diary's content is important and a great read.
When we found Shelton's journal here in the museum, it's a fantastic journal of the Civil War. And then we got a couple of collections of letters that he wrote to his fiancée. We're still working through those. They're fantastic to give insight into the thinking of that culture.
When you read Shelton's diary, you can understand why Jay and Jana are drawn to it. It hops along like a cross between Mark Twain and a boy's own adventure story. But in Jana's excerpted version, there are no spaces in the text or any indication on the pages that words are omitted. An acknowledgement only mentions editing and doesn't explain further. At a cafe a couple of doors down from the museum, I meet with Cecilia Robinson, a volunteer historian for the Clay County African American Heritage Organization. I pass the diary across the table.
This is a Confederate soldier. I'm an African American woman. I know the history of Clay County. I know that it was a pro-slavery county. When Abraham Lincoln ran for president, he didn't get a single vote in Clay County.
Cecilia says she hasn't seen this new publication or the original diary, but tells me history books should present the facts without distortion. However, she accepts the museum's right to present a book however they like.
You see what I'm saying? Mm. It's what you are presenting, what you choose to present about this man. But he is a complete character, so you should present him holistically. You know, character is who you are in the dark.
Then she tells a story. When Cecilia was a professor of English literature, just up the hill at William Jewell College, some campus landscapers came across an obstacle, a small pyramid of rocks with a marker on it.
And the landscapers wanted to remove the Union Monument. And the president of the college and the administration at the time felt that it was okay.
Cecilia says the monument was demolished.
So now, is that a distortion of history?
A William Jewell College spokesperson said they've only ever had 3 Civil War memorials on campus, and all of them can still be found located around the chapel. She didn't know of any that were demolished. But a book in the Clay County Archives confirms Cecilia's story. A picture shows a pyramid of rocks dedicated as a Civil War memorial by a class of William Jewell's own students in 1931. The monument was dismantled in the mid-1990s. Only its marker was moved to the chapel area. That's how what some local historians describe as very likely the only monument dedicated to Union soldiers in Clay County disappeared. It says a lot about the decision-making, intentional and unintentional, that contributes to our historical record.
That was KCUR's Danny Wood checking out responses to a newly published Confederate memoir by a Clay County soldier. Remembering the Civil War is complicated. That's what people will tell you. But is it? I mean, if your ancestors were soldiers who fought for the South, well, yeah, that's complicated. But if your ancestors were slaves hoping for freedom, it might just be harder to see the conflict as anything but black and white. For the rest of today's show on KCUR Central Standard, we're talking about how Missouri deals with its Confederate past. To start, let's get a better handle on what exactly happened here. For that, I'll turn to Jeremy Neely. He's a professor at Missouri State, and he wrote a book called The Border Between Them. Hi, Jeremy.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
What interests you about the Border War?
Well, I'll confess that before I came to the Border War as a historian, I was a basketball fan. And so I knew that there was a difficult history between people in Kansas and people in Missouri, having grown up watching the Tigers and Jayhawks. And the question that animated my research was, how did the people who lived through the Border War get on with their lives? The survivors and the people who'd felt victimized by everything and who'd experienced it. And along the way, I got drawn back into the war itself because it's such a rich and complicated story that you really have to focus upon that. And what I ended up with in my book is a long history of the state line that goes back to pre-settlement days and then the origins of the Western Missouri border, and then looks at the border war as the pivotal event of the 19th century. And then in the last few chapters, I look at its legacy and the contested and dynamic memory is the way that I describe it.
contested and dynamic is a fair way of putting it. Talk to me about Missouri's role in the Civil War, just the facts of that. I mean, was it complicated?
I think it's fair to say that it was complicated, that Missouri as a border state contained within it a whole range of political identities and perspectives, that most Missourians preferred to maintain the status quo, that in 1860 they were the only state that voted for Stephen Douglas, the Northern Democratic candidate. In February of 1861, Missouri holds a convention to decide whether or not to secede from the Union. And it becomes the only slave-owning state that votes to stay, and it votes overwhelmingly. And the men who cast those votes are mostly slaveholders. And so Missourians, as a border state, are caught right there in the middle. And because of that, I think the war in Missouri becomes nastier and more brutal than it was anywhere else.
Why? How does that connect those dots for me? How is the division within the state? You would think that would maybe temper it, just that there was this diversity of viewpoints and that maybe that would make the state less extreme.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. The way that I explain it in my book is that the war in Missouri is much longer than the start in 1861, which people associate with the firing on Fort Sumter. But by that point, the fighting on the Missouri-Kansas line had raged for 5 years. And so you've got almost a decade-long struggle. And I think that by the time 1861 rolls around, people in Missouri have been galvanized by the fight for territorial Kansas, in which many of them have participated. And I think
so the fight to determine whether Kansas is going to be a slave state or a free state.
Yeah, that's right. And I think for many people in Missouri, it becomes an intensely local thing that they know their neighbors' loyalties. They know which side their neighbors are on. And what the war does is it unleashes a lot of hostilities that have been building on for various reasons, you know, over land and water rights. But of course, slavery and secession, that just deepens things even more. And so I think in Missouri, it's because it's this meeting ground of North and South, but also West.
Well, what did that hostility look like other than what you might have seen on the battleground?
Oh, it's what historians have described as a household war, because it really was neighbor against neighbor. And so you have really a terrorism, frankly. You have people harassing their neighbors, stealing from their neighbors, burning their neighbors out of their homes, attacking, killing them. And it's an irregular violence that's not carried out by regular troops or even militia. These are largely self-created bands of partisans, guerrillas, and they come in many different names that eventually in Kansas they'll be known as the Jayhawkers. In Missouri, the early ones are known as border ruffians, and later they're called bushwhackers. But this is a nasty kind of fight even before you have the arrival of Union or Confederate troops.
You know, people say that this war was about more than slavery. Do you see there being truth in that?
Well, I don't think that you can get around slavery. I understand that many people would argue that it's about states' rights, and you'll even have people argue that it's about clashing economies and cultures, and things like the tariff were involved. And I'm not denying that maybe those weren't a part, but the way that I teach this in class and talk about it in the book is that states' rights wasn't just a legal abstraction for these people. I mean, this was a tangible thing. There was one particular state's right that was at stake. And for Missourians, it was the right to own and sell human property and to take that human property into the Western territories. They thought that that was constitutional, as it had been. But that their foes in Kansas, the free soilers and the abolitionists, they believed that it was wrong. And so I think any attempt to sidestep slavery as a root cause misses the mark.
Is there something we lose sight of, though, when we remember only the perspective of the winner in this story, the perspective that this was the war to end slavery? I guess my question is, is there a risk of editing out other voices and viewpoints?
Oh, there is. And one of the things that was really interesting to me as I did the research was that this has been a contested history from the start. That in the immediate aftermath of the war, people in Kansas City and in the counties outside of Kansas City on both sides of the state line are waging this struggle about how best to remember the war. And I went into this as the former basketball fan thinking, you know what, I'm going to find all this bad blood and people talking about how they had been done wrong. But when you look at the newspapers, what you find instead is this wide effort to turn the page, and that this was a bloody and awful past, and that people needed to look instead to the future. And that it, by focusing upon what people had in common, their economic interests, for example, that they would put their best face forward, and that would be more inviting to immigrants and to outside investment. And so the big issue in the latter third of my book is this tension between people who believed that you should tell the history warts and all. I really liked that phrase in Danny Wood's piece. And then the people who thought that, no, you need to be selective and to emphasize the more accessible parts of the past, the things that everybody can agree upon.
I wonder how you see this legacy of the Civil War playing out in Missouri today. Other than basketball.
Well, today the Kansas City area has all sorts of economic border war challenges and you know the difficulties that come with a metropolitan area that straddles a state line. I think what's interesting is the ways in which memories can change over time and the ways in which identities can change over time. And the part of the piece that really I enjoyed near the end was when Danny was describing the disappearance of Missouri Unionists. And I think that's largely been lost because many people forget that Missouri remained a Union state. They chose in 1861 not to leave the Union. And granted, eventually there will be a secessionist government that leaves the state as they're chased out by the Union Army. But it's a government in exile. They're attempting to govern Missouri from Arkansas and then from Texas. And so
that's pretty crazy. I mean,
it is crazy.
And that isn't a well-known piece of this history. Why not?
Well, I think that what happens during the war in Missouri is that you have a large number of these people who wanted to keep the status quo, that wanted to keep the Union together, and they also wanted to keep slavery legal. But as the war changes and it becomes a war for emancipation, not just a war for Union, many people go from being neutral to being pro-Confederate. And so there's a shift in Missourians' identities during the war. And so I think that's part of the story. I think the other part of the story that happens, especially in western Missouri along the state line, is the Union Army's policy in trying to end guerrilla violence will alienate even more people. There's this famous measure that's taken in the summer of 1863 after the massacre at Lawrence carried out by William Quantrill and guerrillas from Missouri, that the Union Army depopulates parts of four counties, Jackson, Cass, Bates, and part of Vernon County. And this was intended to drive out the Southern sympathizers that the Army thought was feeding and sheltering and giving information to the guerrillas. But it's going to affect a lot of Unionists, a lot of unoffending settlers. And so the memories of Order Number 11 will take some people who had, you know, not had hostile feelings towards the Union and sort of galvanize them as well.
I'm curious what you think people's family connections might have to do with how we remember this war. I mean, I've talked to people about this before. I once spoke with a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and he was talking about that, you know, of course, he does not defend slavery and but that people in his family, as he had heard it, were starving during the war. And his relative who died fighting for them, as he saw it, was a hero. Regardless of what side of this conflict he was on, he was defending human beings in his own community who were starving. And I get that, I do. But then you could also look at it from the other side and see someone whose ancestor was a slave in Missouri. And how is that person supposed to feel about arguments that this wasn't about slavery, that this was complicated?
Yeah, and I think that family was crucial to the preservation of memory, because what I found in my research is that you really have parallel memories taking root, that in the newspapers you have this booster version of history, and that the war, well, what the war was about really doesn't matter, because they didn't want to talk about slavery. They didn't want to talk about secession.
Yeah, I've heard the phrase, for reasons best left unacknowledged.
Yeah, that's right. What they wanted to celebrate was the common heroism of soldiers on both sides. that these were men who had been heroic and willing to sacrifice, and that regardless of their politics, that they were determined to protect their families and their communities. And so it strips away all the ideological origins of the war. And what happens within families, though, is this determination to tell the history as they had experienced it. And so the hardships, the ways in which they'd suffered, and it was the history, warts and all. And what you'll see in the 1870s and 1880s is this memory continues to be passed down generation to generation.
If you out there have a family connection to Missouri's Confederate past, whatever that relationship may be, we'd love to hear from you about whether this history feels personal to you and how that colors your perspective. 816-235-2888. That number again, 816-235-2888. Monroe Dodd is here with us, too. He's our go-to guy for anything related to Kansas City history. And Monroe, what do you think it's important to remember about Missouri's Confederate past? Something that you think maybe people don't often remember.
Maybe what's important to remember, because it's still with us in a sense today, is that indeed, although the war was about slavery, it was about states that left the Union because they wanted to preserve what they had, namely slavery, and feared that Abraham Lincoln and the Republicans were going to take that away from them, they seceded. There is also a more primal part about it, which is they didn't want to be told what to do. That is not to replace the cause of the Civil War, but it gets to that thing inside you that says, look, we're happy the way we are. Most Missourians didn't own slaves. Mm-hmm. But they didn't want to be told this way or that way or the other way. Also, there's a role in that for propaganda, for politicians and other things who whip up patriotic fervor and other things that bring people who don't even have a stake in slavery along in order for them to fight for the rights of the few people who did own slaves. And there's also in Missouri. Jeremy mentioned Order Number 11, which is key, especially in western Missouri, to the way people felt about it for generations to come. And there's a perfect example of that story by a family that began with a couple named Solomon and Harriet Young, who settled in Jackson County along the Blue Ridge. They were evacuated under Order Number 11. Their farm had been taken by Jim Lane's and other forces, at least nominally, on the Union side several times during the war. Harriet Young, in 1902, filed a claim against the federal government for money that she said had been taken, for property that had been taken. In 1905, her grandson had just joined the National Guard, and he thought it would be great to wear his National Guard uniform home to Grandma's house for her to see it. She'd be impressed. She told him when he walked through the door, "I don't ever want to see you in that uniform again." And that young man's name was Harry S. Truman, who later did quite a few things to advance civil rights in America, at least by the terms of the 1940s. But Harriet Young kept that memory for 30 to 40 years because of what had happened to them. So it's not only a rich history, it's a very convoluted history, complex history, and emotional.
When we remember these soldiers and honor their stories, is there in your mind a way to do that while still showing clear and unambiguous respect for the struggles of African Americans, given the relationship between the Civil War and slavery?
I think history ought to be told in full, but it also ought to be told in perspective and in context. If I told you there was a guy who really thought that black people weren't equal to white people and shouldn't be living with white people and that they should live apart, you'd probably say, well, I don't think I much cotton to that kind of person. But if I then said that was once a feeling of a guy named Abraham Lincoln in the 1850s and the 1860s, it would change the opinion a little bit, because not only did Lincoln actually feel that way, but he signed the Emancipation Proclamation and led the country through the war that defeated slavery in the end. History is complex. Every one of us has flaws. And if it's good to acknowledge the flaws, but it's also good not to overwhelm the story with the flaws. What's the major thing about Abraham Lincoln? That he signed the Emancipation, president of the United States during that time, or that he felt these other ways? I think it's all part of a person, but it doesn't dominate that. In telling like that, an African American would certainly have a different view of it, of the matter, because to African Americans, the predominant part of their ancestors' lives was they were enslaved, told what to do, and not paid for doing it.
This has surfaced recently for Clay County residents with the publication of that soldier's memoir. Can you think of other times when this history has reared its head and forced people to grapple with it, some event?
I want to differ with Jeremy on one little thing about newspaper coverage after the war. There was a newspaper in Kansas City called the Kansas City Times, owned by, in the early 1870s, owned by an unreconstructed Confederate guy who hired an editor named John Newman Edwards. John Newman Edwards acts as publicist for an outlaw named Jesse James. What does this have to do with the Civil War? His publicity said that James operated under the cloak of the lost cause. He was, in fact, he could be excused for his depredations by the fact that he was striking out for those valiant men who had fought for the Confederacy, blah, 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 and so on.
When you go to the Jesse James Museum and Home, you can still see where the slaves' quarters were. That was part of that story.
And here's John Newman Edwards being his propagandist and chief publicist. And I think historians credit him for making Jesse James the legend he is today.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from a Civil War reenactor who plays parts on both sides and from you. 816-235-2888. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about Missouri's Confederate past. They say it's complicated. Is that true? What do you think? 816-235-2888. I've been chatting with historians Monroe Dodd and Jeremy Neely. Now let's hear from Christian Michael Schuster. He's a Kansas City fashion designer who not only participates in Civil War reenactments, but also makes the uniforms. Hi, Christian.
Good morning.
How did you get into Civil War reenactment?
Well, I started reenacting as a boy. I had a very early interest as a young man from a fashion standpoint in the uniforms and the costumery and the wardrobe of the era. Grew up drawing them and took an active role in finding reenactors, how I could get involved. Started reenacting at the age of 8 and then stopped when I went to college at 18. Got back in after a 6-year break and have been reenacting 25 of my 37 years on this.
Dang. Well, but so you said that your interest is partly in the uniforms. Talk to me about the uniforms. What was it about the uniforms?
Well, my love of the Napoleonic, Victorian, and Civil War era uniforms all stem from that. Those were really the last great eras in fashion and military uniforms. It's not like the uniforms of today where they were meant to camouflage you or hide you from the field, but as the opposite, make you stand out so that you could designate individual units on the field, see exactly where they were, find them in the confusion of the field. And it was really kind of the last great era of military fashion.
I know that reenactment is a thing people do, but it's not something I've personally witnessed. How does it work?
Well, like all things and like our conversation, it can be a little bit complicated, but essentially it's a group of living historians who appreciate an era coming together to celebrate that era and to learn as a unit and to teach through living. Most reenactments are held by individual organizations, whether it be a state or national or a private group. Most of them are centered around an actual battle or event. And they're held all across the state, all across the nation.
What do you mean when you say that you learn and you teach through living? What is it that you learn by embodying a character who participated in this struggle that you might not get from the written historical record? And let's focus, I guess, on the experience of portraying a Confederate soldier.
Sure. I think there's a great deal to be learned in the act of being a living historian. You're going to learn so much more than you possibly can in a book by being on the field, by interacting with other reenactors, by sleeping on the ground, by wearing the clothing, by eating the food, by smelling the gunpowder, by grasping a small appreciation for what our forefathers did in this great struggle, and trying to encapsulate that in just a couple days over a reenactment gives you a great appreciation for how strong these men truly were and how comfortable my bed and air conditioning truly are when I go home.
I understand that you've played soldiers on both sides. Is the experience different for you depending on whether you're a Union or Confederate soldier?
It's not necessarily different for me. The only real difference would be based on the scenario of the individual battle. But reenacting for me is a love of history. It's not necessarily so much about sides. I enjoy and actively portray both Union and Confederate soldiers. It depends on the individual scenario of the battle that we're reenacting at the time and what's needed on the field. And seeing it from both sides is a real joy of mine.
So when you play a specific figure from history, I mean, do you play that like a specific person, or do you just know I'm on this side?
It can at times for specific reenactments be taken down to an individual person that you're portraying. For the most part, most large scale reenactments are going to be based around one, a specific battle. And then when we as reenactors come to choreograph the scenarios that we're portraying on the field, we'll focus on individual actions within the battle, individual days, individual troop movements, and try and as accurately as possible portray and mimic those movements.
I want to get to our calls in a second, but what do you think it is about this piece of our past that has people reliving it, reenacting it, 150 years later? I would be hard-pressed to come up with some other chapter in our history that inspires this kind of behavior to this degree.
Well, I think you're talking about one of the greatest periods in history in us as Americans. It truly shaped who we are as Americans and brought the nation together as a whole.
What do you mean by that? Because what we hear about, I mean, what you've even just described is like uncomfortable conditions, like we've heard about brutality and violence, divisions between neighbors. That doesn't sound great to me.
It doesn't sound great, but what it does is it invokes passion. And I believe reenactors are very passionate people from a historical side, from a genealogy and lineage side. And again, I think the power of teaching history through living it is one of the greatest aspects of American Civil War reenacting. I would say in this day and age, we are so very connected to our devices and our computer screens as I'm going live on Facebook. And the opportunity to teach through smell, through touch, through feel, through hearing, through interaction is so much greater than anything you'll ever learn in a book.
Is part of the greatness of the Civil War the outcome that slavery was illegal or at the end of it?
I would say so. I would say to walk away from the fact that at the end of the day, the Civil War brought about the end of slavery in this nation is not something that can be overlooked, and is a huge piece of our American history as individuals.
Let's talk with Joe in Westwood, Kansas. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Tell me your story.
Well, I am from Nevada, Missouri, which is in Vernon County, and it was burned to the ground in 1853 by Standing Order Number 11. I am one of the most liberal Democrats you've ever met in your life, but I can tell you that people from Nevada are still pissed about that.
They're still telling the story?
Yeah, my great-grandfather fought for Sterling Price, and we have the Bushwhacker Museum in Nevada. Nevada had, when I was in high school, 4 black residents, town of 10,000. Fort Scott had about 40% African-Americans.
On the Kansas side.
On the Kansas side, not 2 miles away. So the memory still lingers. I mean, slavery is the worst thing I ever heard of. But in 1867, after the war is over, people are still killing each other in Vernon County over the war. And I'm not sure I've got a point here, but it's just that it was such a strange time.
Joe, you know, I'm curious about how you grew up hearing about this. I mean, you've said that people are still angry about what happened to your town during the Civil War, but how did you learn about that anger?
Well, I grew up there, and we have a place called the Bushwhacker Museum. And, you know, we're all too old to be thinking about this anymore. But my grandmother still called it the War of Northern Aggression.
Wow.
So the history runs deep.
I want to get our historians talking about this because, first of all, you know, Jeremy Neely, that phrase, the War of Northern Aggression, talk to me about it. I have a friend who grew up in Savannah, Georgia, being taught about the Civil War in those terms. I didn't know people in Missouri also grew up with that phrase.
Yeah, it's a curious thing. And I want to point out to Joe that I actually lived in Nevada for several years after the book came out. And I'd done a lot of the research there at the Bushwhacker Museum. And picking up on Christian's point, I think that the passion that local historical societies and reenactors bring to this is vital in sort of sustaining the past for people living in the present. It's a curious thing that out there on the Western frontier, you had people describing this as a war of Northern aggression, but I think that really takes root after Order Number 11. I think in those counties, when the Union Army forcibly removes people from their homes and then in their absence plunders what's left and then sets fire to the property, it leaves a real bitterness.
Monroe, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's difficult for families not to pass things along to as generations go by. It's difficult for them not to remember, not to know about these things that have happened to grandma and granddad. While who knows what's going on back there? I think, once again, it got to that feeling of being pushed around. And then after the war, there was a sense, I believe, that the Grand Army of the Republic and a lot of people who were on the Union side of the war were going about boasting, demonstrating, and nothing but Republicans were ever elected. On the other side, you were dealing with people who had lost, and that feeling kept on.
We have just a little more time for this conversation about Missouri's Confederate past on KCUR's Central Standard. We've got some calls to get to when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard, where we're talking about the legacy of the Confederacy here in Missouri, on the border with Kansas, which makes it all that much more complicated. We're talking with historians Jeremy Neely and Monroe Dodd, and with fashion designer and Civil War reenactor Christian Michael Schuster. Welcome back, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
So let's get back to some of our callers, because people have really interesting stories about their connections with the past, with slavery, with the Confederacy. Let's talk with Warren in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Warren.
Hi there. How y'all doing?
Good. How about you?
Okay. My name is Warren Watkins, and I'm from the plantations up at the KCI Airport. You know, that was there was about 3,000 slaves in Platte County. We moved to Parkville and then come to Kansas City after slavery. And there's plantations up there, and it's pristine archaeological condition. In other words, the buildings used to be there, and chimneys used to be there, the old plantations. And we've been talking with the city in regards to need a cultural resource management plan to gather all this information and find where the slave graves are buried. Because the white graves are up there. They got nice stones, granite stones. Slaves didn't get in stones at that time. And they've basically been ignoring the fact and basically just writing us out of history in regards to, like, we didn't exist. And so, therefore, we and my foundation, Watkins Foundation Historical Society, have been trying to work with the city to restore and to tell these stories. Because you have to tell these stories, you bring it up and tell it like it was, and that's where it was that time. And so that's where the healing begins. You got to heal some kind of.
Warren, I want to.
So, therefore, these stories. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to find out more about your interactions with the city. Of course, we'll have to talk to the city also to do that. But I'm curious whether there are other other aspects of the way people talk about history that, I mean,
well, yeah, they that, don't want to talk about it. Will you talk about?
No, go on.
Hello?
Yeah, please go on.
All right, they don't want to talk about slavery. They don't want to talk about all this in the past. But see, the past now is coming up to the future. The airport wants to expand, and the Grays are going to just build bulldoze and just put on top and buried underneath. And that history is very important. Good or bad, it's still part of the history. That's the way it was. So that's how we get to the future in regards to dealing with the past. You can't just cover it up. You can't just ignore it or write you out of history like it wasn't even there. I mean, you got to face those things. And that's how you go before the go to the future in regards to faith.
Warren, like you're doing good work, right? Warren. I wish you luck.
Yeah. And
well, you got to try. I mean, you can't sit back and just tell one side of the story without telling the other. Now, there was a court case back in where the descendants of the slaves, in which I testified, and the descendants of the slave owners, which are still up there, and we testified and got together to fight the city in regard, no, you can't move these graves. And we won that case. But they've been still destroying the artifacts up there, the old buildings, and they want to move the graves and the slaves and never try to find the slave graves. And so that's we're fighting. We're fighting the idea of you can't just write us out of culture and the history. You just can't do that.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for calling, Warren. I want to talk to our historians a little bit about some of the stuff he's talking about. What do you know about, I mean, I know that gets us into a really specific kind of situation, but when we talk about how we remember things, graves are an example, grave markers are an example of how people remember their own relatives and other people who represent something to them. Monroe?
Mm-hmm. Markers of all kinds are more important than we think. Often we'll pass by a marker every day and pay no attention to it. But it's nevertheless getting ingrained in our minds. And I think everything from a grave marker in a cemetery to a glorious monument to Union soldiers or Confederate soldiers, whoever, replete with flags and statues and all that, all those things serve as what it appears at least to be. Everything in the world is transient, but it appears to be rather permanent. And it appears to, and it will be the kind of thing that sets off a little code in our brains, the way landmarks do, the way places where we met our first love would do, or all the things that go on in the human emotion, in the human mind, can be symbolized often in a marker like that, or in the presence of a thing like the cemetery he's talking about.
Let's talk. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything for you to add, Jeremy?
Oh, I was just going to add with what Warren was saying. This is a vital part of history that deserves to be remembered. What I would say is that the preservation of history requires defenders. It requires people working together, organizations, and it sounds like the kind of effort that he's leading. But throughout the past, the monuments that we have in Missouri, the cemetery that was in Danny Wood's piece in Kansas City and at the Confederate home over towards Higginsville, that all comes out from the efforts of the Sons of Confederate Veterans and the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And as Monroe mentioned, the Grand Army of the Republic, that it takes coordination, it takes fundraising, it requires raising public awareness. And so I think this is important work.
Okay, let's hear from Nancy in Independence. Nancy, we don't have a lot of time, so we'll have to be kind of quick. Sorry about that.
Well, I come from a family that settled here in 1833, and they had slaves. I think the wife of Adam Hill inherited them. He was a Whig who was for gradual emancipation, feeling that a person should be able to earn a living and support his family in an era with no welfare. And so I'm not sure what he did, but in probably before November of 62, he took all 12 to Texas, where he stayed during the war. Now, one side will say, ha, 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 he was preserving his property. But if he had the idea, even that this was not his property, it was his minor children's property, that's another aspect that needs to be figured in some cases.
What do you mean? I'm sorry, I don't quite understand.
Well, as legal guardian of minor children of inheriting from their deceased wife, their mother, he was legal guardian, and he didn't own the slaves. He was guardian on behalf of their mother, who was deceased, and they were not yet 21.
Okay, I think I see. You know, it sounds...
And then, so he went to Texas, and in November of 62, his house was not burned, but his blacksmith shop was raided and burned to the ground. And he was one of the prominent blacksmiths in between Independence and Westport, on Westport Road. They came back sometime maybe 65 and reoccupied the farm and the house. And by that time, by 1867, the younger son had died. The daughter had been disowned, which is another story. And one unmarried son and father lived in the house by themselves. This was a house.
Nancy, I am so sorry to hurry you along, but I need to get to the end of this story because we're running low on the show. And I don't want you to miss the punchline of your story. Can you tell us crucial piece of it?
The punchline is that finally when the son married, he had five boys. They all attended Marmaduke Military Academy in Sweet Springs. They all went over to the university. All five of them played football. Three of them were lettermen. Two of them were captains. And the only game worth playing was KU.
All right. Well, thank you, Nancy. Thanks. That's a funny place to end. But this idea of this sort of, something that Nancy's call makes me wonder is whether it is really important for people to make some kind of peace with their family's history or with the history of the place where they live, that it's hard to just look back and say, maybe a person was wrong. Maybe what happened here wasn't happening always for the noblest reasons. I mean, that seems like that is a hard thing for people to do. Is it part of our identity, what happened in a place or within our family before us, even when it wasn't you doing it, Jeremy?
Well, there are examples from history of the people who will never be able to get over it. The victims of the Lawrence Massacre, their surviving family members will, to the day they die, condemn the actions of Quantrill's men, and some of Quantrill's raiders will be unrepentant about what they had done. And so I think there's that part of our past, but part of the contribution I wanted to make with my book was to show people that there's also the possibility of reunion. And it's not easy, and it certainly isn't inevitable, but it does require people talking to one another. And it requires engaging with history, even with its warts, and to begin to have dialogue about that. And until you do, I think it is difficult to overcome.
Monroe, what are your thoughts?
Human memory and human history are just inextricably bound. You can't get over something that happened in your past, even in your own life. If something you were ashamed of doing when you were 12 years old, you still remember it. You have to put it aside. You have to move on with your life, but you still remember it. And I think that's the way some of these family and civilizational traditions are. It comes, or tribal traditions, you might call them. They come down. You can't forget them. But the key in human life, I think, is to overcome that feeling. If your ancestors...
But does that involve acknowledging...
Yes. Acknowledging it and then saying, and that's in the past. That was there. I don't deny it, but I'm going to be a better person than that. You know, striving to get better. It's something about progress in that that's emotional.
Tell me your thoughts, Christian.
I think this entire radio program hits on the point that emotions run deep. You can hear it in the voice of any and every single caller. And I think a great way to find closure in all of this is, as a Civil War reenactor, to experience it. So I would encourage anyone interested or fighting feelings like that to come out and try the hobby of American Civil War reenacting. We've got great living historians in the area, and we'd encourage you to come out and play with us. I'll give you a website, www.firstmissouribattalion.com. Come out and play.
Our time is up for this conversation. Jeremy Neely, author of The Border Between Them, thanks for joining us from Missouri State University.
Thank you, Gina. Enjoyed it.
Civil War reenactor and fashion designer Christian Schuster, thank you.
Thank you.
And Monroe Dodd, as always, a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Gina.
We'll have this discussion available online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And we had so many calls, I'm sorry that we didn't have time to get to all of them. If you want to keep talking to us on Twitter, we're at @KCURCST. Tomorrow, it's a food show all about lunch. Also, we have a new podcast. It's called Midwesternish. Maybe I'm biased, but I think you'll really like it. Go to kcur.org to learn more. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next, so don't go away.